Part 3. James. 1. The war came one morning, suddenly and unexpectedly. It was announced on September 23, 1980, the day before the opening of schools and universities. We were in the car returning to Tehran from a trip to the Caspian Sea when we heard about the Iraqi attack on the radio. It all started very simply. The newscaster announced it matter-of-factly, the way people announce a birth or a death, and we accepted it as an irrevocable fact that would permeate all other considerations and gradually insinuate itself into the four corners of our lives. How many events go into that unexpected and decisive moment when you wake up one morning and discover that your life has forever been changed by forces beyond your control? What triggered the war? Was it the arrogance of the new Islamic revolutionaries who kept provoking what they deemed to be reactionary and heretical regimes in the Middle East, and inciting the people of those countries to revolutionary uprisings? Was it the fact that the new regime held a special animosity towards Saddam Hussein, who had expelled the exiled Ayatollah Khomeini from Iraq after reportedly making a deal with the Shah? Was it the old hostility between Iraq and Iran and the fact that the Iraqis, with promises of support from a West hostile to Iran's new revolutionary government, dreamed of a swift and sweet victory? In retrospect, when historical events are gathered up, analyzed, and categorized into articles and books, their messiness disappears and they gain a certain logic and clarity that one never feels at the time. For me, as for millions of ordinary Iranians, the war came out of nowhere, one mild fall morning, unexpected, unwelcome, and utterly senseless. All through that fall, I took long walks around the wide leafy alleys near our home, surrounded by scented gardens and meandering streams, and thought of my own ambivalence towards the war. For my anger was mixed with feelings of love and a desire to protect my home and country. One September evening, it was that twilight moment between seasons when for a very short time the air is filled with a mixture of summer and fall, I was diverted from my thoughts by the colors of a magnificent sunset unfolding in front of me. I happened to catch the play of fading light between the thin branches of a creeper on a nearby clump of trees. I stood there watching the diaphanous reflection of the sunset until two passers-by, walking from the opposite direction, distracted me, and I continued on my way. Down the slope of the street, on the wall to my right, in big black letters, was a quotation from Ayatollah Khomeini, saying, "This war is a great blessing for us." I registered the slogan in anger. A great blessing for whom? 2. The war with Iraq began that September and did not end until late July 1988. Everything that happened to us during those 8 years of war and the direction our lives took afterward was in some way shaped by this conflict. It was not the worst war in the world, although it left over 1 million dead and injured. At first, the war seemed to pull the divided country together. We were all Iranian, and the enemy had attacked our homeland. But even in this, many were not allowed to participate fully. From the regime's point of view, the enemy had attacked not just Iran. It had attacked the Islamic Republic, and it had attacked Islam. The polarization created by the regime confused every aspect of life. Not only were the forces of God fighting an emissary of Satan, Iraq's Saddam Hussein, but they were also fighting agents of Satan inside the country. At all times, from the very beginning of the revolution and all through the war and after, the Islamic regime never forgot its holy battle against its internal enemies. All forms of criticism were now considered Iraqi-inspired and dangerous to national security. Those groups and individuals without a sense of loyalty to the regime's brand of Islam were excluded from the war effort. They could be killed or sent to the front, but they could not voice their social or political preferences. There were only two forces in the world, the army of God and that of Satan. Thus, every event, every social gesture also embodied a symbolic allegiance. The new regime had reached far beyond the romantic symbolism more or less prevalent in every political system to inhabit a realm of pure myth with devastating consequences. The Islamic Republic was not merely modeled on the order established by the Prophet Muhammad during his reign over Arabia, it was the Prophet's rule itself. Iran's war with Iraq was the same as the war carried on by the third and most militant Imam, Imam Hussein, against the infidels, and the Iranians were going to conquer Karbala, the holy city in Iraq where Imam Hussein's shrine was located. The Iranian battalions were named after the Prophet or the 12 Shia saints. They were the army of Ali, Hussein, and Mahdi, the 12th Imam, whose arrival the Shia Muslims awaited, and the military assaults against Iraq were invariably codenamed after Muhammad's celebrated battles. Ayatollah Khomeini was not a religious or political leader, but an Imam in his own right. In those days, I had become an avid and insatiable collector. I saved pictures of martyrs, young men, some mere children published in the daily papers beside the wills they had made before going to the front. I cut out Ayatollah Khomeini's praise of the 13-year-old boy who had thrown himself in front of an enemy tank and collected accounts of young men who were given keys to heaven to wear around their neck as they were sent off to the front. They were told that when they were martyred, they would go straight to heaven. What had begun with an impulse to record events in my diary turned gradually into a greedy and feverish act of hoarding, as if through such actions I could place a jinx on forces beyond my control and impose upon them my own rhyme and reason. It took us a while to understand what the war really meant, although the radio, television, and papers were filled with it. They encouraged people to take advantage of the blackouts and use the system of alarms to instruct us. After the red siren, a voice would say, "Attention, attention, this is the alarm. Please go to your shelters." Shelters? What shelters? Never once, during the 8 years of war, did the government create a cohesive program for the safety and security of its citizens. Shelters meant the basements or the lower levels of apartment houses that sometimes buried you. Yet most of us did not realize our own vulnerability until later, when Tehran was also hit, like the other cities. Our ambivalent attitude towards the war mainly stemmed from our ambivalence towards the regime. In those first air raids against Tehran, a house in the affluent part of the city was hit. It was rumored that its basement had been occupied by anti-government guerrillas. Hashemi Rafsanjani, then Speaker of the Parliament, in an effort to appease the frightened population, claimed in a Friday prayer ceremony that the bombing so far had done no real harm, as its victims were the arrogant rich and subversives who probably would have been executed sooner or later anyway. He also recommended that women dress properly when sleeping, so that if their houses were hit, they would not be indecently exposed to strangers' eyes. 3. "Let's celebrate," my friend Lale cried before sitting down at a table in our favorite restaurant where I had been waiting for her. This was a few weeks after our encounter with the Committee on the Cultural Revolution, and by now we knew it was only a matter of time before we would either have to comply with the rules or be expelled. Since the government had recently made the veil mandatory at the workplace, I did not see much reason for her exuberance. "Celebrate what?" I wanted to know. She said, "Today," paused and took an excited breath. "After 9 years, 8 and a half to be exact, I was formally expelled from the university. I am now officially irrelevant, as you would put it, so lunch is on me. Since we can't drink publicly to my newly acquired status, let's eat ourselves to death," she added, in a brave effort to make light of a development that would leave her penniless and, more important, force her to give up a job she loved and was good at. Stiff upper lip, I believe they call it. Well, this stiff upper lip was becoming quite a trend among friends and colleagues. She had gone to the university that day to discuss her situation with the head of the psychology department, where she had been teaching since her return from Germany a few years earlier. And she had not worn a headscarf, of course. Of course. The guard at the gate had called out to her from inside his cage. As I imagine it now, the guard's post is literally a cage, a large protrusion of bars, but it may have been more of an outpost, made of metal, perhaps, or cement, with a window and a side door. I could pick up the phone and call Lale, who 2 years ago finally moved to the U.S. and now lives in Los Angeles. I could ask her. She, unlike me, has a very precise memory. "Have you come across that new guard?" she asked me, a limp, captive lettuce leaf dangling from the end of her fork. She went on to say, "The clumsy one, with a mournful countenance, the very big one." She was trying to avoid using the word fat. No, I had not had the pleasure of meeting the aforementioned guard. "Anyhow," she said, "he is of Oliver Hardy dimensions." "Bigger," she said, chewing now on her lettuce with ferocious determination. But the resemblance ends there. I mean, this guy was flabby, but not jovial, one of those dour, mirthless, overweight men who don't even enjoy their food. "You know the type," she said. "Could you please lay off the guard of the mournful countenance," I pleaded with her, "and get on with your story?" She attacked a small cherry tomato that kept slipping from under her fork and did not begin again until she had finally speared it. "He came out of his cage," Lale at last continued, and said, "Ma'am, your ID, please?" So I took out my ID and waved it in his face and started walking. But then he called me again. "Ma'am, you know you can't go in like this." I said, "I've been going in through this gate like this for the past 8 years. "No, ma'am, you have to have a head cover. New orders." "That's my problem," I said, "not yours." But he wouldn't let it rest. He said, "I am authorized to stop any woman who..." At this point, I interrupted him. "I am not any woman," I said, with all the authority I could muster. "It's right here," he protested, A written order signed by the president himself that no girl, he corrected himself, no woman is to pass in your condition. He said, in your condition, I asked. Yep, that's what he said. I took another step, she said. He blocked my way. I took a step to the right. He took a step to the right. I stopped. He stopped. For a few seconds, we stood there looking at each other, and then he said, if you go through in that condition, I will be held responsible. In what condition? I asked him. The last time I checked, I was the only person responsible for my condition, so don't you go around claiming responsibility for me. I don't know what perversion made me argue with this poor guy, said Lale, her hand now trembling in excitement, and to tell him things he couldn't possibly understand. For a few minutes, we just stood there. And then, on a sudden impulse, I looked over his shoulder to the left, and as he turned around, I ducked and started to run. To run, I asked. Yes, I ran. At this point, we were served our veal scallopini and mashed potatoes. Lale began to search for some hidden treasure in her potatoes, making investigative circles with her inquisitive fork. She said at last, I thought he'd give up. I mean, all he had to do was take the bloody phone and call the higher authorities. But no, not him. I stopped for a second to look back to see if he had fallen off. But there he was. And I swear, he pulled his belt up and swung his hips from side to side. He swung his hips, I asked. She said, honestly, he did. She made a swinging movement with her fork inside the mashed potatoes. And then he started to run after me, she said. Lale and the fat guard had sprinted across the wide, leafy avenues of the university. Every once in a while, Lale would look back to see if he was still at it. But she swore that every time she stopped, rather than trying to catch up with her, he'd come to a halt, as if pushing invisible brakes to a sudden stop. Then he'd pull his belt up, do the thing with his hips, and continue the chase. He reminded me, she said, of a panting, clumsy, giant fish. Lale ran by three startled students, made it down the short steps leading to the Faculty of Persian and Foreign Languages and Literature, nearly toppled herself as her heel caught in a crack past the wide open area in front of the building, ran up past the open door into the cool, dark hall and up the wide flights of stairs to the second floor, where she came to a sudden halt at the entrance to the Department of Psychology and nearly fell into the arms of her department head, who was standing in the doorway talking to a colleague. He tried to cover his embarrassment by exclaiming, "What's the matter, Professor Nasri? Has there been an uprising?" A few moments later, the dutiful guard, sweat trickling down his cheeks like tears of desperation, his cap in his hand, came to a grinding halt by the door. There he made his explanations, and the department head, not knowing whether to laugh or frown, dismissed him, promising to make a proper report to the proper authorities. An hour later, Lale had emerged from the door of the department, walked back to the entrance gate, and without so much as glancing at the guard, had marched out a free woman. A free woman? I asked. Yes, she said. I was given a choice, to immediately comply with the rules or be sacked. I chose not to comply, so now I'm a free woman. What will you do? I asked, as if I were not myself in exactly the same position. I don't know, she shrugged. I guess I will go back to sewing or baking cakes. This was the astonishing thing about Lale. She looked like the last person in the world to bake a cake, but she was an accomplished tailor and a fantastic cook. The first time I met her, she struck me as everything that I was not. Tidy and rather dry, the kind of person you would call correct. Her German education added to this illusion. I used to tease her that the word immaculate had been created for her. When I got to know her better, I came to see that all this orderliness was a camouflage for a passionate nature matched by insatiable desires. Her hair was thick and obstinately unmanageable. It would not succumb to comb, brush, gels, even perms. Yet she tamed it through hours of painstaking straightening and styling, giving her the appearance of an exacting and foreboding matron. "I have to either shave my head or do it this way," she would tell me, her voice tainted with exasperation. Only her big black eyes, flickering with mischievous designs, belied her otherwise conservative appearance. Later, when she would climb the trees with my 3-year-old daughter, I could see the amount of discipline it must have taken for her to control her wayward longings. As it happened, she was forced to make a living from her sewing for almost 2 years. She was not granted a license to practice child psychology, her specialty, and she had refused to teach with the veil. So she took up sewing, a task she abhorred. And for a while, I and our other friends would go around wearing pretty chintz skirts with beautiful flower patterns until a friend asked her to work at her school. Our appetites that day seemed insatiable. Lale ordered a creme caramel, and I, 2 scoops of ice cream, vanilla and coffee, with Turkish coffee and a side of walnuts. I sprinkled my walnuts thoughtfully over the coffee-drenched ice cream. We brooded over the fact that in our department, Farideh had been expelled and Dr. A had left for the States. Our more cautious colleagues, who had managed to remain unscathed, said that Farideh's expulsion was more a result of her headstrong resistance, a certain mulishness, as one colleague creatively put it, than the administration's efforts. 4. A few days later, I went to the University of Tehran for one more meeting with Mr. Bahri. He had asked for this meeting, hoping to convince me to comply with the new rules. I was fully prepared for a running contest at the gate, but to my surprise, I was not accorded the same treatment as Lale. The morose guard on duty was not the one she had described. He was neither lean nor fat. He did not even ask for my ID. He simply pretended not to see me. I had my suspicions that Mr. Bahri had warned him not to interfere. The conference room looked and felt just as it had when I first met Mr. Bahri to discuss the role of literature and revolution. Large, cool, and bare, with a dusty feel to it, although, except for the long table and 12 chairs, there were no surfaces to collect dust. Mr. Bahri and his friend were already sitting near the middle of the table, facing the door. They both stood up when I entered and waited until I had taken a seat before settling back down. I chose to position myself opposite them. Mr. Bahri did not take long to get to the point. He mentioned Lale's escapade and the administration's admirable patience with what he called this sort of behavior. All through the meeting, his eyes appeared to be glued to a black fountain pen, which he kept turning around and around in his hands like a curious object whose mystery he was hoping to fathom. He and his friends were well aware that before the revolution, whenever Professor Nasri went to the poorer, more traditional areas of town, she wore a scarf. "Yes," I said coldly. "She did this out of respect for those people's faith, and not because it was mandatory." All through this talk, Mr. Bahri's friend remained almost completely silent. Mr. Bahri could not understand why we were making such a fuss over a piece of cloth. Did we not see that there were more important issues to think about, that the whole life of the revolution was at stake? What was more important? To fight against the satanic influence of Western imperialists, or to obstinately hold on to a personal preference that created division among the ranks of the revolutionaries? These might not have been his exact words, but they were the gist of his language. In those days, people really talked that way. One had a feeling in revolutionary and intellectual circles that they spoke from a script, playing characters from an Islamized version of a Soviet novel. It was ironic that Mr. Bahri, the defender of the faith, described the veil as a piece of cloth. I had to remind him that we had to have more respect for that piece of cloth than to force it on reluctant people. What did he imagine our students would think of us if they saw us wearing the veil when we had sworn never to do so? Would they not say that we had sold out our beliefs for a few thousand tumans a month? What would you think, Mr. Bahri? What could he think? A stern Ayatollah, a blind and improbable philosopher king, had decided to impose his dream on a country and a people and to recreate us in his own myopic vision. So he had formulated an ideal of me as a Muslim woman, as a Muslim woman teacher, and wanted me to look, act, and in short, live according to that ideal. Lale and I, in refusing to accept that ideal, were taking not a political stance, but an existential one. No, I could tell Mr. Bahri, it was not that piece of cloth that I rejected. It was the transformation being imposed upon me that made me look in the mirror and hate the stranger I had become. I think that day I realized how futile it was to discuss my views with Mr. Bahri. How could one argue against the representative of God on earth? Mr. Bahri, for the time being at least, derived his energy from the undeniable fact that he was on the side of right. I was at best a stray sinner. For a few months, I had seen it coming, but I think it was that day, after I left Mr. Bahri and his friend, that it first hit me how irrelevant I had become. When I left the room, I did not make the mistake of trying to shake his hand. Mr. Bahri walked with me like a polite host, seeing an honored guest to the door, his hands firmly clasped behind his back. I kept repeating, "Please don't bother," and almost toppled down the stairs in my eagerness to get away. When I had nearly reached the first floor, I looked back. He was still standing there, in his frayed brown suit, his Mao shirt buttoned up to the neck, hands behind his back, gazing down at me with a look of perplexity. "A lover's goodbye," Lale would later mischievously say, as I told her my story over another dish of ice cream, this time in the cool of her living room. When I left Mr. Bahri that afternoon, I walked for about 45 minutes and stopped by my favorite English bookstore. I went in there on a sudden inspiration, fearful that I might not have the opportunity to do so in the near future. And I was right. Only a few months later, the Revolutionary Guards raided the bookstore and closed it down. The big iron bolt and chain they installed on the door signified the finality of their action. I started picking books up with a greedy urgency. I went after the paperbacks, collecting almost all the Jameses and all six novels by Austen. I picked up Howard's End and a room with a view. Then I went after ones I had not read. Four novels by Heinrich Böll, and some I had read a long time ago, Vanity Fair and The Adventures of Roderick Random, Humboldt's Gift, and Henderson the Rain King. I picked up a bilingual selection of Rilke's poems and Nabokov's Speak Memory. I even lingered for a while debating over an unexpurgated copy of Fanny Hill. Then I went after the mysteries. I picked up some Dorothy Sayers and to my utter delight found Trent's Last Case, two or three new Agatha Christies, a selection of Ross MacDonald's, all of Raymond Chandler, and two Dashiell Hammetts. I didn't have enough money to pay for them all. I took the few I could afford and refused the bookstore owner's very gallant offer to take the rest on credit. As he placed the books I had put on hold in two large paper bags, he smiled with amusement and told me, "Don't worry, no one is going to take these away from you. No one knows who they are anymore. Besides, who wants to read them now, at this time?" Who indeed? People like me seemed as irrelevant as Fitzgerald was to Mike Gold, or Nabokov to Stalin's Soviet Union, or James to the Fabian Society, or Austin to the revolutionaries of her time. In the taxi, I took out the few books I had paid for and surveyed their covers, caressing their glossy surfaces so giving to the touch. I knew that my meeting with Mr. Bahri meant it would only be a matter of time before I was expelled. I decided I would stop going to the university until they expelled me. Now that I would have a great deal of time on my hands, I could read without any feelings of guilt. 5. The government didn't take long to pass new regulations restricting women's clothing in public and forcing us to wear either a chador or a long robe and scarf. Experience had proven that the only way these regulations would be heeded was if they were implemented by force. Because of women's overwhelming objection to the laws, the government enforced the new rule first in the workplaces and later in shops, which were forbidden from transacting with unveiled women. Disobedience was punished by fines, up to 76 lashes, and jail terms. Later, the government created the notorious morality squads, four armed men and women in white Toyota patrols monitoring the streets, ensuring the enforcement of the laws. As I try now to piece together the disjointed and incoherent events of that period, I noticed how my growing sense that I was descending into an abyss or void was accompanied by two momentous events that happened simultaneously: the war, and the loss of my teaching job. I had not realized how far the routines of one's life create the illusion of stability. Now that I could not call myself a teacher or a writer, now that I could not wear what I would normally wear, walk in the streets to the beat of my own body, shout if I wanted to, or pat a male colleague on the back on the spur of the moment, now that all this was illegal, I felt light and fictional, as if I were walking on air, as if I had been written into being and then erased in one quick swipe. This new feeling of unreality led me to invent new games, survival games, I would now call them. My constant obsession with the veil had made me buy a very wide black robe that covered me down to my ankles, with kimono-like sleeves wide and long. I had gotten into the habit of withdrawing my hands into the sleeves and pretending that I had no hands. Gradually, I pretended that when I wore the robe, my whole body disappeared. My arms, breasts, stomach, and legs melted and disappeared, and what was left was a piece of cloth, the shape of my body, that moved here and there, guided by some invisible force. The beginning of this game I can trace back quite successfully to the day I went to the Ministry of Higher Education with a friend who wanted to have her diploma validated. They searched us from head to foot, and of the many sexual molestations I have had to suffer in my life, this one was among the worst. The female guard told me to hold my hands up. "Up and up," she said, as she started to search me meticulously, going over every part of my body. She objected to the fact that I seemed to be wearing almost nothing under the robe. I explained to her that what I wore under my robe was none of her business. She took a tissue and told me to rub my cheeks clean of the muck I was wearing. I explained that I wore no muck. Then she took the tissue herself and rubbed it against my cheeks, and since she did not achieve the desired results, because I had not worn any makeup, as I had told her, she rubbed it even harder until I thought she might be trying to rub my skin off. My face was burning and I felt dirty. I felt like my whole body was a soiled, sweaty t-shirt that had to be cast off. That was when the idea of this game came to me. I decided to make my body invisible. The woman's coarse hands were reverse x-rays that left only the surface intact and made the inside invisible. By the time she had finished inspecting me, I had become as light as the wind, a fleshless, boneless being. The trick to this magic act was that in order to remain invisible, I had to refrain from coming into contact with other hard surfaces, especially with human beings. My invisibility was in direct ratio to the degree to which I could make other people not notice me. Then, of course, from time to time, I would make part of me return, like when I wished to defy an obstructionist figure of authority and I would leave a few strands of hair out and make my eyes reappear to stare at them uncomfortably. Sometimes almost unconsciously I would withdraw my hands into my wide sleeves and start touching my legs or my stomach. Do they exist? Do I exist? This stomach, this leg, these hands? Unfortunately, the Revolutionary Guards and the guardians of our morality did not see the world with the same eyes as me. They saw hands, faces, and pink lipstick. They saw strands of hair and unruly socks where I saw some ethereal being drifting soundlessly down the street. This was when I went around repeating to myself and to anyone who cared to listen that people like myself had become irrelevant. This pathological disorder was not limited to me. Many others felt that they had lost their place in the world. I wrote rather dramatically to an American friend, "You ask me what it means to be irrelevant. The feeling is akin to visiting your old house as a wandering ghost with unfinished business. Imagine going back. The structure is familiar, but the door is now metal instead of wood. The walls have been painted a garish pink. The easy chair you loved so much is gone. Your office is now the family room, and your beloved bookcases have been replaced by a brand new television set. This is your house, and it's not. And you're no longer relevant to this house, to its walls and doors and floors. You are not seen." What do people who are made irrelevant do? They will sometimes escape. I mean physically. And if that is not possible, they will try to make a comeback, to become a part of the game by assimilating the characteristics of their conquerors. Or they will escape inwardly and, like Claire in The American, turn their small corner into a sanctuary. The essential part of their life goes underground. My growing irrelevance, this void I felt within me, made me resent my husband's peace and happiness, his apparent disregard for what I, as a woman and an academic, was going through. At the same time, I depended on him for the sense of security he created for all of us. As everything crumbled around us, he calmly went about his business and tried to create a normal and quiet life for us. Being a very private person, he focused his energies on safeguarding his life at home with family and friends and on work. He was a partner in our architectural and engineering firm. He loved his partners, who, like him, were dedicated to their work. Since their job was not directly related to culture or politics, and the firm was private, they were left in relative peace. Being a good architect or dedicated civil engineer did not threaten the regime, and Bijan was excited by the great projects they were given: a park in Esfahan, a factory in Borujerd, a university in Qazvin. He felt creative and he felt wanted. And in the very best sense of the term, he felt he was of some service to his country. He was of the opinion that we had to serve our country regardless of who ruled it. The problem for me was that I had lost all concept of terms such as home, service, and country. I became again the child I had been when I would indiscriminately and waywardly pick up books, slouch in the nearest available corner, and read and read. I picked up Murder on the Orient Express, Sense and Sensibility, The Master and Margarita, Herzog, The Gift, The Count of Monte Cristo, Smiley's People, any book I could get my hands on in my father's library, in second-hand bookstores, in the still unravaged libraries in friends' houses, and read them all, an alcoholic drowning her inarticulate sorrows. If I turned towards books, it was because they were the only sanctuary I knew, one I needed in order to survive, to protect some aspect of myself that was now in constant retreat. My other sanctuary, what helped restore some sense of sanity and relevance to my life, was of a more intimate and personal nature. On April 23, 1982, my niece Sanam was born, prematurely. From the moment I saw her, small and curled under a machine that was there to keep her alive, I felt a bond, a warmth. I knew she would be good for me and good to me. On January 26, 1984, my daughter Negar was born. And on September 15, 1985, my son Dara. I have to be precise in terms of the day, month, and year of their births, details that twinkle and tease every time I think of their blessed births and have no compunction in becoming sentimental over their coming into this world. This blessing, like other blessings, was mixed. For one thing, I became more anxious. Until then, I had worried for the safety of my parents, husband, brother, and friends. But my anxiety for my children overshadowed all. When my daughter was born, I felt I was given a gift that in some mysterious way preserved my sanity. And so it was with the birth of my son. Yet it was a source of constant regret and sorrow to me that their childhood memories of home, and like my own, were so tainted. My daughter Nigar blushes every time I tell her that her particular brand of obstinacy, her passionate defense of what she considers to be justice, comes from her mother's reading too many 19th century novels when she was pregnant with her. Nigar has a way of throwing her head to the right and back in one move and pursing her lips just a little in defiance of whatever authority she's protesting at the moment. I embarrass her, and she wants to know, why do I say such impossible things? Well, I respond, don't they say that what a mother eats during her pregnancy, as well as her moods and emotions, all have an effect on the child? While I was pregnant with you, I read too much Jane Austen, too much of the Brontes, George Eliot and Henry James. Look at your two favorite novels of all time, Pride and Prejudice and Wuthering Heights. But you, I added with glee, you are pure Daisy Miller. I don't know who this Daisy or Maisie or whatever of yours is, she tells me, pursing her lips, and I won't like James. I know. Yet she is like Daisy, a mixture of vulnerability and courage that accounts for these gestures of defiance. Her way of throwing her head back, which I first noticed when she was barely 4 in the waiting room of a dentist's office of all places. And when Dora jokingly asks, what about me? What did you do when you were pregnant with me? I tell him, just to defy me, you turned out to be all that I imagined you would not be. And the moment I say this, I begin to believe it. Even in the womb, he took upon himself the task of proving my nightmarish anxieties wrong. While I was pregnant with him, Tehran was the object of continual bombings, and I had become hysterical. There were stories about how pregnant women gave birth to crippled children, how their mother's anxiety had affected the unborn fetus in irremediable ways. And I imagined mine to be infected with all these maladies, that is, if we were spared and lived to see the birth of this child. How could I know that instead of my protecting him, he was coming into the world to protect me? 6. For a long time, I wallowed in the afterglow of my irrelevance. While doing so, I was also unconsciously examining my options. Should I give in to this non-existence imposed upon me by a force I did not respect? Should I pretend to comply and then cheat the regime in secret? Should I leave the country, as so many of my friends had done or had been forced to do? Should I withdraw from my job in silence the way some of my most honorable colleagues had done? Was there any other option? It was during this period that I joined a small group who came together to read and study classical Persian literature. Once a week, on Sunday nights, we gathered at one of the participants' houses, and for hours we studied text after text. Sunday nights, sometimes during the blackouts by candlelight, in different houses belonging to the different members of the group, we would gather year after year. Even when our personal and political differences alienated us from one another, the magical texts held us together. Like a group of conspirators, we would gather around the dining room table and read poetry and prose from Rumi, Hafiz, Sa'di, Khayyam, Nizami, Ferdowsi, Attar, Bayhaqi. We would take turns reading passages aloud, and words literally rose up in the air and descended upon us like a fine mist, touching all five senses. There was such a teasing, playful quality to their words, such joy in the power of language to delight and astonish. I kept wondering, when did we lose that quality, that ability to tease and make light of life through our poetry? At what precise moment was this lost? What we had now, this saccharine rhetoric, putrid and deceptive hyperbole, reeked of too much cheap rosewater. I was reminded of a story I had heard and reheard about the Arab conquest of Persia, a conquest that brought Islam into Iran. By this account, when the Arabs attacked Iran, they won because the Persians themselves, perhaps tired of tyranny, had betrayed their king and opened the doors to their enemies. But after the invasion, when their books were burned, their places of worship destroyed, and their language overtaken, the Persians took revenge by recreating their burned and plundered history through myth and language. Our great epic poet Ferdowsi had rewritten the confiscated myths of Persian kings and heroes in a pure and sacred language. My father, who through my childhood would read me Ferdowsi and Rumi, sometimes used to say that our true home, our true history, was in our poetry. The story came back to me then because, in a sense, we had done it again. This time, we had opened the gates not to foreign invaders, but to domestic ones, to those who had come to us in the name of our own past, but who had now distorted every inch of it and robbed us of Ferdowsi and Hafez. Gradually, I started to take on projects with this group. I used the material culled from my dissertation on my gold and proletarian writers of the 30s in America to write my first article in Persian. I persuaded a friend from the group to translate a small book by Richard Wright, The American Hunger, and I wrote the introduction. It covered Wright's communist experiences, his trials and ordeals, and his final break with the party. Later, I encouraged my friend to translate Nabokov's Lectures on Russian Literature. I translated poems by Langston Hughes. A member of our group, a well-known Iranian writer, encouraged me to write a series of articles on modern Persian fiction for a literary magazine he edited, and later to participate in weekly literary discussions with young Iranian writers. This was the beginning of my writing career, which has stretched over almost two decades to the present. I created a protective shell around myself and started not thinking, but writing, mainly literary criticism. I flung my diaries into the corner of my closet and forgot about them. I wrote without ever going back to them. My articles gained recognition, yet I seldom felt complete satisfaction with them. I thought most were too tidy and rather pompous and learned. I felt passionate about the subjects I wrote about, but there were conventions and rules to follow, and I missed the impulsiveness and enthusiasm I could bring to my classes. In class, I felt I was having an exciting dialogue with my students. In my articles, I became a rather dry teacher. My articles succeeded for the exact reasons that I disliked them. Their learned claims won me respect and admiration. 7. There should be a clear and logical reason why one day out of the blue I picked up the phone and called my magician. It is true that I had begun to brood too much over my unsatisfactory intellectual life, true that I missed my classes and felt restless and desperate, but still I don't know why on this particular day and not the day before or after I decided to call him. There were so many myths around him that he saw only a select few, that at night if the light in one of his rooms facing the street was on, it was a sign that he would see visitors, Otherwise, they shouldn't bother him. These stories did not impress me. In fact, they were the one reason I hesitated to call him. He had created such an elaborate fiction out of his relationship with the world that the more he claimed to be detached, the more he seemed to be actually involved. The myths were his cocoon. In that land, people created cocoons, elaborate lies to protect themselves, like the veil. So we will settle for the fact that I called him impulsively for no very good reason. One afternoon, I was alone at home, reading all day instead of working. Every once in a while, I would look at my watch and say, I will start work in half an hour, in 1 hour. I'll quit as soon as I've reached the end of the chapter. Then I'd go to the refrigerator and make myself a sandwich, which I ate as I continued to read my book. I think it was after I had finished the sandwich that I got up and dialed his number. 2 rings, and I heard a voice on the third. Hello? Mr. R? Yes. I am Azar. A pause. Azar Nafisi. Oh, yes, yes. Can I see you? But of course. When would you like to come? When is best for you? How about the day after tomorrow at 5? Later he explained that the size of his apartment was such that he could answer the phone from anywhere in his apartment on the third ring. Otherwise, it meant that he was either out or did not wish to answer. No matter how intimate we became, I always saw myself the way we were in that first meeting. I sat opposite him on the lonely chair and he on the hard brown sofa. Both of us had our hands on our knees. He, because it was customary with him. Me, because I was nervous and had unconsciously adopted a school kid's pose in front of a much respected teacher. Between us, on the table, he had set a tray with 2 dark green mugs of tea and a box of chocolates. Immaculate squares of red with black lettering, Lindt. A rare luxury, all the more so because they could not be found in the shops where foreign chocolates were sold at exorbitant prices. The chocolates were the only luxury he treated himself and his visitors to. There must have been days when he went almost hungry, but he did have a store of chocolates in that half-empty refrigerator, which he did not eat much of himself, but reserved for friends and visitors. I forgot to add, it was a cloudy, snowy day, and would it matter if I told you that I wore a yellow sweater, gray pants and black boots, and he a brown sweater and jeans? Unlike me, he appeared very confident. He acted as if I had come to ask for help and our task was to set up an elaborate rescue plan. And in a sense, it was true. He talked as if he knew me, as if he knew not only the known facts, but also the unknown mysteries, thus creating a formal intimacy, a shared strangeness between us. It seemed from that first meeting that, like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, we entered into a conspiracy, not a political one, but one cooked up by children to protect them against the grown-up world. He finished my sentences for me, articulated my wishes and demands, and by the time I left, we already had a plan. This was what was good about him. People who went to see him somehow ended up with some plan or another, whether it was how to behave towards a lover, or how to start a new project, or structure a talk. I don't remember too clearly the exact nature of the plan I went home with, but he does, I'm sure, for he seldom forgets. I had not finished my tea and did not eat my chocolate, but I did go home giddy and satiated. We had talked about my present life, the intellectual state of affairs, and then about James and Rumi all in one breath. Without intending to, we had strayed into a long and pointless discussion that had sent him to his immaculate library, and I left with a few books under my arm. That first day colored our relationship, in my mind at least, until the day I left Iran. I stopped growing up in relation to him because it suited and even pleased me to do so, absolving me of certain responsibilities. While he had created around himself the illusion of a master, of someone always in control, he may not have been quite so much in control as I thought him to be, and I was not quite such a helpless novice. I usually went to see him twice a week, once for lunch and once in the early evening. Later, we added evening walks around my house or his, during which we exchanged news, discussed projects, gossiped. Sometimes we went to a favorite coffee shop or restaurant with an intimate friend of his. Apart from that friend, we had two other friends in common who owned a bookstore that had become a meeting place of writers, intellectuals, and young people. With them we enjoyed occasional lunches and excursions to the mountains. He never visited my house, but often sent my family tokens of his regards, a box of chocolates which they had come to identify with him and even expect. On certain days of the week, videos, books, and sometimes ice cream. He called me Lady Professor, a term less odd and more often used in Iran than here. He said later that when friends asked him after our first meeting, "What is the lady professor like?" he had said, "She's okay, she's very American, like an American version of Alice in Wonderland." Was this a compliment? Not particularly. It was merely a fact. Have I already mentioned that his favorite actress was Jean Arthur and that he liked Renoir and Minelli, and that he wanted to be a novelist? 8. Turning points always seem so sudden and absolute, as if they have come bolt out of the blue. That is not true, of course. A whole slow process goes into their making. When I look back, I cannot trace the exact process that suddenly led me back into the classroom against my own will, almost wearing the veil I had vowed never to wear. The signs coalesced in all sorts of small events, like the sudden phone calls from various universities, including the University of Tehran, asking me to teach. When I refused, they always would say, "Well, how about one or two classes, just to get a feel for how things are right now?" Many would try to convince me that things had changed, that people like me were in demand, the atmosphere had become more relaxed. I did teach a course or two at the Free Islamic University and the former National University, but I never accepted to return as a full-time faculty member. By the mid-80s, a new brand of Islamists were gradually coming into being. They had begun to sense that all was not right with the direction the revolution was taking and decided it was time to intercede. The lack of progress in the war with Iraq was taking its toll. Those who had been ardent revolutionaries at the start of the revolution, people now in their late teens and early 20s, and the younger generation who were coming of age were discovering the cynicism and corruption of the leaders who had taken power. The government also had discovered that it needed the cadre it had so casually expelled from the universities to meet the growing demands of the student body. Some within the government and some former revolutionaries had finally realized that there was no way the Islamic regime could make us intellectuals vanish. In forcing us underground, it had also made us more appealing, more dangerous, and in a strange way, more powerful. It had made us scarce and, because of this, also in demand. So they decided to have us back, perhaps partly to be more certain of their control, and they started to contact people like me who had once been branded as decadent and westernized. Mrs. Rezvan, an ambitious teacher in the Department of English at the Allameh Tabatabai University, was one of the intermediaries between the more progressive Islamic revolutionaries and the alienated secular intellectuals. Her husband had been a Muslim radical at the start of the revolution, and she had connections with the progressive revolutionaries and the secularists, with the insiders and outsiders. She was determined to use both to her advantage. This Mrs. Rezvan seemed to have cropped up out of nowhere, bent on changing the course of my life through the sheer force of her will. I remember our first meeting well, partly because it was during one of those periods known in the history of the war as the War of the Cities. Sporadically, the two sides carried out ferocious attacks for a sustained period on certain key cities such as Tehran, Isfahan, and Tabriz in Iran, and Baghdad and Mosul in Iraq. Usually, the fighting relaxed for a time after that, until the next bombing attack, which could sometimes last as long as a year. It was mid-morning in the winter of 1987. My daughter, who was now 3, and my 1.5-year-old son and I were alone at home. Tehran had been hit by 2 rocket attacks earlier that morning, and I was trying to divert my children's attention by playing a favorite song involving a rooster and a fox on a small tape recorder. I was encouraging my daughter to sing along. It sounds too much like a sentimental movie, Brave Mother, Brave Children. I did not feel brave at all. The seeming tranquility was due to an anxiety so paralyzing that it translated itself into calm. After the attacks, we went to the kitchen and I made them lunch. We then moved to the hall where we felt more secure because there were fewer windows. I built for them houses of cars that they destroyed with a touch of their small hands. Right after lunch, the phone rang. It was a friend who had been one of my graduate students the previous year. She wanted to know if I could come to her place on Wednesday night. Mrs. Rezvan, a colleague of hers, really wanted to meet me. She liked me, had read all of my articles. Anyway, my friend concluded, Mrs. Rezvan is a phenomenon in her own right. If she didn't exist, we would have to invent her. So could you come, please? A few nights later, in the midst of another blackout, I set off to my friend's house. When I got there, it was already dark. As I entered the large hall, from the depth of darkness, I could see flickering in the light of a kerosene lamp a short, stocky woman dressed in blue. Her physical appearance is perfectly clear and alive in my mind. I can see her plain face, the sharp nose, short neck, and dark cropped hair. But none of this captures the woman who, at the height of our intimacy, after we had visited each other's houses, once our children had become almost friends, and our husbands got to know each other, remained always Mrs. Rezvan. What I cannot describe is her energy, which seemed to be caged inside her body. She appeared to be in constant motion, pacing her small office, my living room, the halls of the university. She always seemed determined, not only to do certain things herself, but to make others, whom she targeted carefully, perform specific tasks that she had outlined for them. I have seldom met anyone whose will was so physically imposing. It was not the plainness of her features, but the determination, the will, and the half-ironic tone of her voice that remained with you. Sometimes she would come to my house unexpectedly, in such an anxious state that I would think some disaster had befallen her. Yet it would only be to inform me that it was my duty to participate in some meeting or another. She always framed these requests as matters of life and death. Some of these so-called duties I'm grateful for, like forcing me to meet with a handful of progressive religious journalists who are now fashionably called the reformists, and to write for their journals. They were fascinated by Western literature and philosophy, and I discovered to my surprise that there were many points on which we could agree. "It is such a privilege to meet you," she told me that evening, the first time we met. "I want to become your student." She said this with a perfectly serious expression, without a trace of humor or irony. This threw me off balance so violently that I immediately disliked her. I became shy and couldn't respond. That night, she did most of the talking. She had read my articles. She knew me from certain friends and students. No, she was not trying to flatter me. She really wanted to learn. Then she told me, "I must teach at their university, the only liberal university in Iran, which still had some of the best minds. The head of the department, you will like him. Not a man of literature, but a serious scholar. The state of literature in this country could not be any worse, and the state of English literature is most hopeless of all. We, those of us who care, must do something about this. We should leave our differences aside and work together." After our first meeting, she pressured me through various intermediaries to accept her offer to teach at Allame Tabatabai University on a regular basis. She called me incessantly, evoking God, students, my duty to the homeland, to literature. It was my task in life to teach at that university. She made promises. She promised to talk to the president of the university, to whomever I wished her to talk to. I told her I did not want to wear the veil in the classroom. "Did I not wear the veil," she asked, "whenever I went out? Did I not wear it in the grocery store and walking down the street?" It seemed I constantly had to remind people that the university was not a grocery store. "What's more important," she countered, "the veil or the thousands of young people eager to learn?" I asked, "What about the freedom to teach what I wanted?" "What about it?" she responded conspiratorially. "Haven't they banned any discussion of relations between men and women, drinking, politics, religion? What is there left to talk about?" I said. "For you," she said, "they would make an exception. Anyway, things are much freer now. They have all had a taste of good things. They want to get there too. Why not teach them James or Fielding or whoever? Why not?"